Hello, hello. How are we doing this morning? Well, it's morning for me. I don't know if you're listening to this in the early hours of the AM, but if you are you having a pleasant morning? I'll try not to yell at you. It's early. Have you had your coffee yet? You should have some coffee because I'm having my second one. Yeah, yeah. So let's do this. What are we going to do today? Well, today I have three tales that are each probably equally creepy, but completely different. And I fully confess to just pulling up three websites after some searching that I think did a really good job of telling these tales and went to closer to the source material of these tales. You'll see what I mean as I read them to you. Before I get to that, what you been watching out there lately? You guys all caught up on Obi-Wan Kenobi? Y'all up in the Star Wars stuff? Or have you watched The Batman yet? Like I was telling you a few episodes ago that you should because I watched it like six times. What about The Boys? Where's my people out there who are watching that sick stuff? Don't get me wrong, I love it, but oh, that is one twisted ass show. And what else did I want to say? What else am I going to throw out there? I have a new book out. I was mentioning it before, but it is officially released and doing okay, actually. I'm very pleasantly surprised, happy. I hope you would check it out. Urban Fantasy, Male-Male Romance. It's got a bit of a supernatural twist to it. I feel like if I say too much, I would totally spoil it. But you can find it on Amazon.com. Every country, all countries. It is in paperback and Kindle and on Kindle Unlimited. So if you have that subscription, you can read it for free on your Kindle Unlimited. Please check it out. I've already got a couple of 5-star reviews. Thank you so much to everyone who's read it so far. I'm so excited. Okay. I got that out of the way. I'll save the other self marketing for later. So which story shall I start with today? Well, have you ever heard of something called a Demogorgon? Well, you might be, because it's the name of a monster in Dungeons and Dragons. So if you've played that, you've heard of it. But it is also the name of a monster in the American science fiction horror web television series Stranger Things, which, full disclosure, I am not watching, but a lot of you are, so you've probably heard it. But now the story of how the name Demogorgon came about is really bizarre, and I am reading to you today from talesoftimesforgotten.com for this particular story. As it turns out, this famous monster most likely originates from a single scribal error made by an unknown copyist in an unknown manuscript sometime around 2,000 years ago or so. Somehow, from these humble origins, Demogorgon went on to be mentioned by great writers including Christopher Marlowe and John Milton, who of Paradise Lost, before eventually becoming one of the most iconic monsters of today. The ancient Greek word Demiurgos, I know I'm saying that wrong, and they even spelled it to their credit. They wrote it in Greek on here, so I was like, Demiurgos? I don't speak Greek. Somebody enlighten me. Demiurgos. It is a term that was commonly used in Pythagorean and Platonic philosophical circles to describe a craftsman-like figure who was thought to have created the cosmos. And at some point, though, it seems that a scribe misread the accusative form of this word, Demogorgon, and they copied it as Demogorgon, which was a completely meaningless word. So the word Demogorgon is first attested in an ancient commentary traditionally attributed to the scholar I should have practiced this 500 more times before I tried to read it to you. Lactantius Placidus, who lived circa 350 to 400 AD. And it's attributed to him on the Thebaid,
an epic poem written in Latin by the Roman poet Publius Papinius Statius. What a name, huh? Is. Like, for real. All of them end in that. Publius Papinius Statius. And he lived 45 to 96 AD. The surviving text of Lactantius Placidus's commentary states the regarding, Dicit diem Demogorgona summum, siascir nomen non licet. Obviously, I don't speak Latin either, but what it means is, he speaks of the Demogorgon, the supreme deity, whose name is not permitted to know. So eventually, the belief that this Demogorgon was the oldest of all divinities became entrenched in the Latin West as part of the canonical mythology. There's an Italian writer, Giovanni Boccaccio, who lived from 1313 to 1375, helped popularize the term Demogorgon by using it in his influential Latin treatise on mythology, which is entitled Genealogiae Deorum Gentilium. Now, as an occult entity, over time, the identity of the Demogorgon shifted. During the early modern period, which would be 1450 to 1750, it was common for writers to appropriate the names of classical deities as the names of demons, since many people believed that the deities that had been worshipped in classical times were actually demons. You know, I'm going to pause here and just say that this is a good theme for after I told you my new book that came out, okay? Just saying. Are you intrigued? Okay. Yes, I gotta plug it. Of course I do. Who else will? All right, back to the article. Thus, the Demogorgon went from being a vague ancestral deity in Renaissance mythography to a malevolent demon of hell. Isn't that just what always happens? Always demonizing the cool guys. Now, Dutch demonologist Johan Weyer, who lived from 1515 to 1588, listed Demogorgonas, I get the plural, one of the demons of hell in book two of his demonological, words are hard this morning, yo, treatise De Praegesis Daemonum et Incantationibus ac Veneficis. I didn't really prepare, I need more coffee. Similarly, in act one, scene three of the tragical history of the life and death of Dr. Faustus, and it is tragical, I did not misread that, written at some point between 1589 and 1592 by English playwright Christopher Marlowe, who lived 1564 to 1593, the name Demogorgon occurs as part of the Latin incantation delivered by Dr. Faustus to summon the demon Mephistopheles. Here we go with more, okay. Sint mihi di atrontis propiti, valit numen triplex Jehovah, ignae arae aquantanti spiritus, salvete, orentis princeps, Beelzebub, inferni ardentis, monarca et demogorgon, propitamus, vos ut aperit et surgat, Mephistopheles dragon quod tumeris, per Jehovam, genanam, e consecratum, aquenquam nunc spargo, sigunt cruci quad nunc facio, e per voto nostra, ips nunc surget, nomus dictatus, Mephistopheles. And I do so humbly apologize to anyone who actually speaks that language and really hates me right now. But that was the incantation. Demogorgon is also mentioned in book two in the epic poem Paradise Lost, written by English poet John Milton, who lived from 1608 to 1674, and it was originally published in 1667 as the name of one of the inhabitants of the realm of chaos, through which Satan, the protagonist of the poem, must pass on his journey from hell to earth. And this is the passage in which the Demogorgon is mentioned, book 2, lines 959 through 967. When straight behold the throne of chaos, and his dark pavilion spread wide on the wasteful deep, with him enthroned sat sable-vested night, eldest of things, the consort of his reign, and by them stood Orcus and Hades, and the dreaded name of Demogorgon. Rumor next, and chance, and tumult, and confusion, all embroiled, and discord with a thousand various mouths. As a result of all these passages from literature associating Demogorgon with Satan, demons, hell, and black magic, Demogorgon came to be thought of as the name of some kind of horrible, malevolent demon. Despite this, Demogorgon's appearance remained ambiguous. You will notice that none of the sources mentioned have given any kind of detailed description of the Demogorgon's appearance. And their other sources really are no more descriptive than this webpage here, and this person's, what they're saying is the sources they looked up. Now, Dungeons and Dragons, that's the part you're waiting for, right? So this was the role-playing fantasy game, and it first endowed Demogorgon with a specific appearance. So in case I didn't make that clear, Dungeons and Dragons is the first to actually give Demogorgon a real, distinct appearance. So kudos to you guys, all right? The character was first introduced in the game in 1976, supplementary rulebook Eldritch Wizardry, and it was written by Gary Gygax, G-Y-G-A-X. That's a very, I've never seen that surname, that's interesting, and Brian Bloom. In the game, Demogorgon is portrayed as an 18-foot-tall reptilian monster with two heads resembling those of mandrills or possibly baboons. It has legs resembling the legs of a chicken, arms ending in long tentacles resembling those of octopodes. Okay, I'm already creeped out. That's gnarly, you guys. And though the Dungeons & Dragons version of Demogorgon was originally just a terrifying, extremely powerful monster, in subsequent iterations of the game, an entire mythology developed surrounding him. In the game, Demogorgon possesses powers of mind control and can bend the wicked to his will. Looking at the Demogorgon symbol can make people go evil or insane. He also has a cult of humans who worship him. In present versions of the game, Demogorgon's two heads are named Amul and Hethradaya. The heads are rivals, and each head is constantly seeking to destroy the other. That's amazing. I would like to see that argument. Amul prefers to use tricks and deception over devastation, whereas Hethradia, I know you D&D players are going to come at me now. Come at me, bro. Prefers simply to destroy. Now we move to Stranger Things. Prior to the release of the first season of Stranger Things, July 15th, 2016, Demogorgon was already well known to readers of classical literature, of course, and players of D&D. But the television show brought the monster to even greater prominence. In Stranger Things, the monster that is referred to as the Demogorgon is a horrifyingly, vaguely humanoid creature from another dimension referred to as the Upside Down. The monster has slimy skin, a tall, thin body that looks unnaturally elongated, and a featureless face that opens to reveal a flower-like mouth with five petals lined with sharp teeth. It cannot speak, but it does make all kinds of growling and shrieking sounds. I will share pictures of all of these, by the way, on my Twitter at PodPinky and Instagram Pinky_podcast. And sometimes I show some stuff on TikTok, S_Reut. And there's a picture here of the Stranger. Any of you watch Stranger Things, you've seen it. So the actual name of the creature, if it has one, has not actually been revealed on the show, I guess. But the characters in the show do refer to it as Demogorgon. So apparently there would be a different name for it on the show. So in conclusion, in this article they say, as strange and silly as it sounds, it seems that a minor transcription error in some long-lost Greek manuscript of some unknown Platonic treatise made by some anonymous scribe around 2,000 years ago gave us the name of one of the most iconic television monsters of the past decade. If the scribe copying that manuscript had just read a bit more carefully and copied the Greek word correctly, then the Demogorgon monsters from Dungeons and Dragons and Stranger Things would have had a completely different name. Shall we come up with one? You can tweet me if you come up with a really cool name. And the author here is Spencer McDaniel, and she is an aspiring historian, mainly interested in ancient Greek mythology. So, kudos. Well done. She finishes up here by saying, "History works in strange and mysterious ways. Nearly all the works written in antiquity have been lost, but yet something as seemingly silly and inconsequential as a typo can affect an entire culture millennia later. It makes you wonder how our actions in the present will affect the future." Mm-hmm. I agree with you. Good article. Good job. All right. Are you ready for the next one? Let's see if I'm warmed up a bit now and can stop tripping over my own tongue. Hopefully the next ones don't have so much Latin and everything else. It's like I love Greek mythology and stuff like that, but, you know, sometimes the names are hard. Which one shall I go to next? All right, let's do this. Have you heard of Black Annis, which is basically the British boogeyman? Annis has borne many names over the years: Black Anna, Black Annie, Black Agnes, as well as Cat Anna. Her dwelling was a cave called Black Anna's or Black Anna's Bower in the low-lying Dane Hills on the outskirts of Leicester. Anna is supposed to have clawed the cave out of sandstone rock using naught but her long and very sharp nails. At its mouth grew a pollarded oak in which Black Anna's crouched in order to pounce on unsuspecting children. These she carried off into her cave, sucked them dry of blood, and ate their flesh before draping the flayed skins of her victims out to dry on the oak's branches. She wore a skirt sewn from the skins of her human prey. As she also preyed on animals, local shepherds blamed any lost sheep on her hunger. Many a generation of Leicester's young, if either naughty or out after dark, were told, "Watch out, or Annis'll get you." By the late 19th century, her cave was filling up with earth. A housing estate, built just after the First World War, now covers the area. A 19th century eyewitness said that the cave was 4 to 5 feet wide, 7 to 8 feet long, and it had a ledge of rock for a seat running along each side. A tunnel was said to connect Black Annis's bower with Leicester's castle, and she had free run of its length. An account of Annis was related by evacuee to Ruth Tongue in 1941. 3 children were sent out by their wicked stepmother to collect firewood. As night descended, they feared to see Black Annis, who only came out after dark, for, it was said, daylight would turn her to stone. They heard a snuffling and, through a hole in their witch stone, saw Black Annis. Unable to escape her whilst carrying the faggots, "That's firewood. Don't come at me." I'm just reading from the article. It's British. That's firewood. They dropped them and ran. Annis bloodied her legs on the bundles and, mumbling and cursing to herself, went to her bower to rub her legs with salve. Then she came back for the children and caught up with them at their cottage door. Their dad came out with an axe and hit Annis full in the face. She began to run for her cave, shouting, "Blood! Blood!" But just then the Christmas bells began to peal and she fell down dead. And that was all a direct quote from that evacuee. So the evacuee claimed Annis's howling could be heard as far as 5 miles away, and when Annis ground her teeth, the sound was so loud that all the people had time to lock and bar their doors. This evacuee also said that because people didn't have window glass in those days, witch herbs were tied above the apertures to stop Annis reaching inside with her long arms to grab their babies. It was why Leicester cottages only had one small window. Annis was said to be very tall, with a blue face, long white teeth. Other descriptions say Annis's teeth were yellow rather than white, and that she only had one eye. But all agree that her face was hideous and blue. A Leicestershire poet, John Hayrick Jr., 18th century, wrote of her,
"Vast talons foul with human flesh there grew in place of hands, and features livid blue glared in her visage, while the obscene waste warm skins of human victims close embraced."
So in history, although the origins of the Anna story are, as is the nature of folklore, unknown, there were two 15th century women who, it has been suggested, might be the origins of Black Annis. It is likely that Annis's tale existed in the 15th century and the women's lives became part of the folklore. The first is a Dominican nun, Agnes Scott, who lived as an anchorite and is described as a hermit of the forest. She wore the long black habit of her order and died in 1455. Swithlands Church bears a brass plaque in her memory, as well as a 3-foot veiled statue of her. From a translation of the Latin inscription, Agnes is surmised to have lived in a cave near the Dane Hills, and from there ran a leper colony. Unfortunately, the connection between her and Black Annis was made by Robert Graves. You may have heard of that poet. His insight might have been visionary. It may have been nothing more than poetic license. Nevertheless, it's an interesting speculation. The second woman is rather more tenuous in her association with Black Annis, for she is the witch or wise woman who foretold Richard III's death. As he rode over Leicester's Bow Bridge on his way to the Battle of Bosworth, his spur or foot struck a stone in the bridge. The wise woman told Hal on his return it would be his head that hit the stone. When Richard's corpse was brought back over Bow Bridge, his head did indeed hit the same place. A tablet was put on the bridge, newly built last century, this says, saying his head was dashed and broken as a wise woman forsooth, or had foretold, who before Richard's going to battle, being asked if his success, said that there his spur struck his head would be broken. That's a direct quote too. A more recent reference, 1767 that is, to Black Annis's bower is a mock hare hunt, where actually they used a dead cat, which was reenacted every Easter Monday, and this is known as Black Monday, or was known. The cat, soaked in aniseed, was dragged from the bower through Leicester streets to the mayor's door. In later years, this gave way to an annual event known as the Dane Hills Fair. Finally, Annis also turned up in Victorian melodramas, such as Black Anna's Bower or The Maniac of the Dane Hills, a tale about the murder of the landlady of the Blue Boar, which was a place Richard III spent the Battle of Bosworth Eve, by the way. Annis was portrayed in the same manner as Macbeth's Three Witches. In The Broken Heart, she is a woman demented by the murders of her baby and spouse. In 1989, she appeared in Freda Warrington's recommended fantasy, The Rainbow Gate, which is based in Bradgate, Parkland, former home of Lady Jane Grey. Now, what about the Gateway to Hell? H-E-L, single L. The remains of a standing stone called the Humber or Holston Stone is not far from the village of Humberstone. Also called Hell or Holy Stone, it was believed that fairies lived in it for people heard their groaning. Folklore claims there was a nunnery on this spot, and from it to Leicester Abbey ran an underground tunnel. The tunnel and the groaning bear a resemblance to Annis's story, especially as it been suggested that there once was a cave near the Hellstone in which she was also supposed to dwell. And it was also called the Hell Hole. Whether any credence can be attached to this is doubtful. For one thing, Humberstone is on the other side of the city center to the Dane Hills, and there's never been any suggestion that Annis had spread beyond the Dane Hills. However, the name Hell may be from the same root word as holy, but it could also be derived from Hel, H-E-L, the Nordic denizen and occasional goddess of the underworld. So although Hell's name was taken by the Christians for their place of perpetual torture, her kingdom was one of ice and cold. Now, she was sired by Loki, the trickster, on Angerboda. Hel was one of three children, and it was Odin himself who gave her the underworld kingdom Niflheim, which is Mistworld. Here she had power over the nine worlds, for in each was a portion of Niflheim. Garm, which is a ferocious dog, sat at the entrance, which is kind of reminds you of Cerberus as well. And it was reminiscent also of Anubis. Hecate, another underworld goddess, was associated with the crossroads. Had her side, I just mentioned this, Cerberus, a triple-headed dog who guarded the path to Hades. Hel is portrayed either with the face, which is half human and half blank, or as she is known as a pied being, half black, half white, or even blue. Annas, though not pied, is described as being blue-faced, which, hey, could even be maybe she had woad. There's another one to toss in there. Or a terrible appearance, as she is said to have. Brigide of Ireland also has a face either pied, half youthful, half crone, or half beautiful, half ugly. Though in these descriptions blue is being used in a fearsome sense, it must be remembered that this color is usually associated with protection, and Madonnas and sky goddesses are also depicted with blue mantles. How about as a Caliach? Gentle Annie, or Gentle Annis, is a Scottish legend whose name may be derived from Anu. This is quite likely, for many Scottish myths share an origin with the Irish. References are widespread, coming from the lowlands as well as the highlands. She is said to have been a weather spirit watching over the gales on the Firth of Cromarty. As spasmodic squalls can blow up in moments, Gentle Annie has a reputation for treachery. Presumably, she was called gentle in the fearsomely polite way that we would refer to elven folk as fair, in terror of offending them. She is associated with Caliach Bheir, Ireland's Caliach Bheir, and is seen as the winter face of the goddess. The stories of the two are united in Miltic, or Mjolstuk, who is a watery form of Caliach Bheir. A lot of people would just have ended up referring to this as a witch, okay? Old gray lady. Whilst in the sea, Mjolteck's form was scaly, but on land she became a hag who raised winds and sea storms. Caliach Bheir had one eye in a visage of mackerel blue, and her teeth were red. She was the queen of winter, and at winter's end she drank from the well of youth. The waters transformed her into the queen of summer. You can see the nature reflected in that, right? Winter, yes. Annis, though not associated with winter and summer as such, was, according to that Evacuees tale that I read to you, was associated with night. Night in the year's wheel equates with winter, but whether there was a summer version of Annis is unknown. But now how about as Brigitte? So Caliach Bheir kept the princess bride captive in a cave, forcing her to wash Bheir's mantle. Bride eventually escaped and married Angus, who was the king of summer. Here, Bheir was winter and bride is summer. Bheir, by keeping bride captive, actually keeps the spring from rising. And so here we have something reminiscent of Persephone, except that Persephone's lover is winter rather than summer. Demeter, incidentally, who is Persephone's mother, assumes the appearance of an aged crone in a great black cloak when Persephone is taken to the underworld. So even though stories of the King of Summer don't equate necessarily with Bride or Brigitte of Ireland, Brigitte and Angus in Irish mythology, there are the children of the Dagda, brother and sister, rather than husband and wife. And as already stated, in some legends, Bheir is both winter and summer in different guises. The transformation is made by Bheir drinking from that well of youth, at both the conclusion of winter and summer, so both times. As bride in some legends is summer, this makes Bheir and bride possibly one and the same. Bheir, representing winter, yields to bride as summer at Imbolc, which is also known as St. Bride's Day, thus making it pretty conclusive, according to this author, that bride is also Brigitte, or the goddess Brigitte, or Brigid. So I find this all really fascinating. I don't know if you guys do, but I love all this mythology and how it overlaps. And again, I didn't plan this, but it actually kind of keeps in a nice theme with my new book, Dark Wings. Yeah, I'm going to plug it again. It goes on to talk about Bel and the Summer King, and I'm not sure that that we need to go over that anymore, and the Caliach tales. This is really a fascinating website, though. whitedragon.org.uk. And they got footnotes and everything here for you. I'll put all of these links in the show notes because there is a lot of stuff here. Goes on to talk about the wild hunter or just a baby eater. And there now they've gone into the Kalyakbir. And then there's the Banshee. Let's read that one. Caves are entrances not only to the underworld, but also to the Celtic land of faerie known as the Hollow Hills. These worlds are also the realms of our ancestors and of the dead. Perhaps Annis, before being debased into a wicked witch, was once a guardian of the Hollow Hills, and getting past her could win you the hidden knowledge of faerie. Indeed, the gifts of civilization supposedly came from the underworld and the gods therein. The indwellers, as well as the hills themselves, are, in Ireland, called the Shi. We've been calling them fairies, okay? A particular group of female Shi are of interest as regards to Annis and Kalyakbir. Though Banshee was originally just a woman of the faerie, it has come to mean a wailing spirit who foretells death. In Scotland, she was called Ban Nai, or Little Washer at the Ford. It is she who washes the blood-soaked garment of those about to die. To meet her washing your linen was, to say the least, a very ill omen. It was in this form that the Irish Morrigan washed the clothes of Cuchulain, foretelling his immediate demise. And Banshee are not a pretty sight. This is getting into some deep mythology that, you know, I've got books on some of this stuff, and you may have heard of some of these things, and I suggest you really look into it because it's all super fascinating. Or maybe I should do some research on pick one in particular. Would you like to hear an episode? Let me know. Sroit at pinkysquarepress.com. You can let me know. There is then, of course, aniseed, cats and oak. So anise is referred to as being derived from Anu, but Leicester was settled by Anglo-Saxons as well as by Danes, and equating their name's origins with a Celtic goddess may not be true. Though her name may derive from Anu, it may also have derived from the aniseed used on the dead cat that I mentioned before, especially as the mock hare hunt is just described as ancient, but don't really know exactly when it started. So which came first, cat anise or the cat and the aniseed? Anise, N-I-S-E, that thing that sort of tastes like licorice, black licorice. Aniseed was believed to avert the evil eye, and on one hand it is used to protect a magician from evil spirits, whilst on the other, you can call forth friendly spirits. So it's conceivable, just a little, that aniseed was used to drive away the witch of the cave. Cats, of course, were often thought to be transformed witch out on the prowl. And oaks, of which there's much folklore and legend connected to them. Apart from the one being called Herne's Oak, it was the oak that fueled the perpetual fires that were burnt at Kildare by the women of Bride. There are a ton of footnotes here, so if, like I said, if you want to look this up, it's a fascinating page. White Dragon, let me see this again, whitedragon.org.uk. And I think they have a lot of other cool stuff here. All right, I did better reading through that one, I think. And now, kind of, since that segued into a Celtic theme, it's appropriate that I am now going to finish with the Irish Times. It's just irishtimes.com, but the Irish Times, it's a periodical here. How the tales of the headless horseman came from Celtic mythology. Did you know that? That's where we get the headless horseman. The Dullahan was a malevolent harbinger who demanded blood sacrifice in the form of decapitation. And this article is by Jessica Trainer. She wrote this around Halloween, so we'll skip that introduction. This week, we're going to look at an Irish ghoul who has made an appearance in ghost stories around the world, the Dullahan, or also known as the Headless Horseman. The legend of a decapitated horseman carrying his own head is one that crops up in numerous European storytelling traditions, from the Middle English of Gawain and the Green Knight to the stories of the Brothers Grimm. Headless horsemen abound, haunting the highways and byways of remote locations and even occasionally marauding our city streets. The Dullahan, or Dark Man, which is what it means, was a malevolent harbinger of death whose roots lie in Celtic mythology. He is said to be the embodiment of Crom Dubh, a fertility god who demanded blood sacrifice in the form of decapitation, and his worship ended with the coming of Christianity in Ireland. Frustrated by the loss of his sacrifice, He still roams the roads, calling the names of those doomed to die, and carrying his head under his arm. The flesh of the face is decayed, with the specific and slightly odd reference to the consistency of the flesh being akin to moldy cheese. This recurs in many tellings of the tale. The Dullahan is recorded in Fairy and Folk Tales of the Irish Peasantry, edited by W.B. Yeats. Quote, an omen that sometimes accompanies the banshee is the coach abawr, or coistblar, an immense black coach mounted by a coffin and drawn by headless horses driven by a Dullahan. It will go rumbling to your door, and if you open it, according to Croker, a basin of blood will be thrown in your face. These headless phantoms are found elsewhere than Ireland. In Norway, the heads of corpses were cut off to make their ghosts feeble. Thus came into existence the Dullahans. So this gruesome process of beheading corpses to ensure their spirits don't roam recalls the origins of another famous Irish horror creation, Bram Stoker's Dracula. Stoker lived in Clontarf, and it is thought that details in his novel might have been inspired by, among many other things, the practice of burying corpses with a stake through the heart at the suicide burial plot at the crossroads of Ballybo and Clonliffe Road, which was another measure to prevent the dead's unquiet spirits from wandering the earth. So it's not difficult to see parallels between these myths. The most famous and lasting iteration of the Dullahan figure must, of course, be the headless horseman featured in Washington Irving's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, which is set in rural New York. The horseman takes the form of Hessian soldiers slain during the American Revolutionary War. Irving was an American citizen whose parents had originally hailed from Cornwall, and the story was written while traveling in England. It's intriguing to see how the Celtic roots of his tale are filtered through the history of America of the day. Sleepy Hollow is as much a satire of materialistic Dutch settler communities as it is a ghost story. As mentioned above, the coistblar, deaf or silent coach, is what it means, often attends the Dullahan as he stalks the night. It's referenced in Thomas Johnson Westrup's A Folklore Survey of County Clare, where a number of stories relating to it are recorded. Quote, on the night of December 11th, 1876, a servant of the McNamara's was going his rounds at Ennistymon. In the dark, he heard the rumbling of wheels on the back avenue, and, knowing from the hour and place that no mortal vehicle could be coming, concluded that it was the death coach and ran on, opening the gates before it. He had just time to open the third gate and throw himself on his face beside it at the bank before he heard a coach go clanking past. It did not stop at the house, but passed on. The following day, Admiral Sir Burton McNamara died in London. Like the Dullahan, the coistblar has made some surprising appearances in more recent pop culture, the first of which, Darby O'Gill and the Little People, has terrified generations with its depiction of that other staple of Irish ghostly legend, the banshee. In Darby O'Gill, the spectral figure of the coistblar comes floating through the air to carry away Darby's daughter, Katie, to the land of the dead. The dead coach or carriage has become a standard of many horror tales, making an appearance at the end of Stephen King's Needful Things, where Leland Gaunt departs the town of Castle Rock in a car that transforms into a death coach. Most recently, a reimagining of the trope appears in the final vignette in the Coen brothers' western, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, where a group of immoral people spend what may be their final journey bickering with each other as the death coach brings them closer to their destination. The roots of Irish mythology have become interwoven with other cultures, creating new traditions and evolved mythologies that forge a strong link between the past and the present. And that, my friends, is my three tales for this episode. What do you think? Do you like more of that? Would you like if I then did some extra deep research on some of those? If you look at my first season, some of these things kind of get touched on because I've done like the Grey Man from Scotland. I've done the episode on cats covered some interesting things. But let me know if you like more mythology or folktales, you know. Sometimes when I get into the cryptid episodes I did, it will get into that. What I find fascinating about this doing this podcast at times, especially when I go into things like this, is just really how connected everything is. And it might change slightly over the centuries, but it all just goes back to an original source eventually. And it's like this massive game of telephone, you know, and it changes as it goes. The more you look into these things, the more you see that we're all connected. And I'm not going to get all kumbaya on you, but I just wish that we could all remember that more. And I think that stuff like this can be really cool for reminding us that we all come from the same place, right? So let's stop hating. Okay, there, I got a little kumbaya. All right, if you have any other ideas or, you know, things that you would like to hear, you can always let me know. I only did two episodes this last month because between the writing and trying to promote the book and other stuff, I don't know, I just didn't, okay? Not that anybody missed me. Oh, boo-hoo. No, not me feeling sorry for myself. I'm fine. If you like anything I do, please like, share, comment. Please pick up my book, Dark Wings, paperback, Kindle Unlimited, available everywhere, Amazon.com. Sorry, I know some of you don't like Amazon, but it's really the best thing for someone who is now an independent author. I did have a publisher in the past, and I got my rights back for reasons. Reasons that I won't go into. It's a long story, and, you know, no ill will towards them. It is what it is. But now you know why. Anyway, find me also on Twitter at PodPinky, Instagram Pinky_podcast, my official website PinkySquarePress.com. Pretty much you can find me everywhere, whether you know, because there I am, right? We're all so online these days. And I'm having a blast on TikTok, but I admit I ended up getting political on it. So if you're not into that, maybe don't go there or just skip those. All right. I hope you're doing well out there, and we'll see what I can come up with for the next Pinky Pod. Poo 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 pew. Pew, 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 pew. Thanks for listening.